like why you should never use your laptop in Pearson Airport. We'll be grateful for that information. I said to Ramsey, I have nothing particularly to pass on. He said to me, well, why don't, there was a small group turned out last time, why don't you tell them about the new master? And I went, what new master? New master came for his first visit. He was, if you read the papers, he was giving a lot of testimony in the Senate. You have never met anyone as glad as this man to be out of the Senate. He's looking forward to it, and he's a lovely guy. And his wife, Donna, is a great character. I think I told some people, I'll just tell it again, he's Jewish, the first Jewish master of this college, and his wife's Anglican. And their daughter at Queen's University was asked, so, your father's Jewish, your mother's Anglican, what are you? And she said, anguish. That's how I think I'll just pass it on.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, John. As you know, when we're planning the club's schedule for the year, we generally try to have at least one book that deals with current affairs. But at the end of last summer, we didn't anticipate, when we chose Ron Deibert's Black Code Inside the Battle for Cyberspace, that it would become more current by the minute. The immediacy of the issues raised in Black Code, particularly regarding the conflict between privacy and national and international security, has been demonstrated by the revelation in the last few days that CSEC, is that how we pronounce it? CSEC, that actually stands for Communication Security Establishment Canada. CSEC had been electronically snooping on all of us Canadians who were at the airport flying off on our summer holidays. A few weeks ago, I sent an email to the master-elect, Hugh Siegel, suggesting he might like to come to tonight's presentation. He had written a piece in the Globe and Mail about the need for a serious review of the principles of national security, given the new challenges presented by WikiLeaks, Edward Snowden's revelations, and many other technological factors. He replied that he would like to come, that he had first met Professor Deibert in 1995 at an experts conference on the digital world, and had been a fan ever since. However, Senator Siegel said he couldn't come tonight because he had obligations in Ottawa. What he didn't anticipate was that this afternoon he would be sitting with an emergency meeting of the Senate Committee on Security and National Defense, asking the head of CSEC and others to explain themselves. The more time I have spent reading Black Code, the more it seems to me to be a really important book, helping us to understand not only the technical implications of the digital world that all of us, however ineptly, are a part of, but the radical political and philosophical implications as well. I think it was not an easy book to write, and I came to appreciate the imaginative and ingenious figures of speech and metaphors that Ron Deibert has used to help the non-technological of us understand enough of the internet to follow along. While reading Black Code, it is worth remembering that Ron Deibert is not in fact a techie by academic background, but a political scientist. His degrees are from UBC and Queens, and his first book, I think, published in 1998, was called Parchment, Printing, and Hypermedia, in which he argued, even then, that the landscape of world politics was undergoing a rapid and fundamental transformation related to the advent of digital electronic telecommunications, and that the most useful way to understand these transformations is through the theories of Harold Innes and Marshall McLuhan. Ron Deibert is a senior fellow here at Massey, professor of political science, and director of the Canada Center for Global Security Studies and of the Citizen Lab at the Monk School for Global Affairs. The Citizen Lab is an interdisciplinary research and development hothouse working at the intersection of the internet, global security, and human rights. It is through the Citizen Lab that Ron Deibert and his colleagues have made many of the astonishing and often disturbing revelations about the use and misuse of the internet. I mentioned the imaginative language that Ron Deibert uses in Black Code to help us understand the post-digital world we now live in. He writes, In a very real sense, we no longer move about our lives as self-contained beings, but as nodes of information production in a dense network of digital relations involving other nodes of informational production. Now, this rather dubious node of information production invites that very dense node of information production, identified as Ron Beaver, to talk to us about black hole.
Thank you so much for that introduction. Yeah, I've got it working. And thanks to Master Fraser, wherever he guests, for having me here again and being such a great host and master of everything here at Massey. While I'm up here, I just want to say it's been great to have you here and huge shoes that are going to have to be filled by Hugh Siegel, a great choice.
His feet are bigger than mine, so.
His feet are bigger than yours, yes. But thank you for everything you do here. I don't really have anything systematically planned for what I was going to say here. I really enjoy having so many people here who have actually read the book, most of you, I hope, to hear what you think and have a chance to have a discussion with you about anything that you'd like to talk about. I will say a few things about the Citizen Lab, about the Snowden revelations, and a bit about what's going on today and in the news. Certainly occupied my time for the last week or so, I would say. But first, about the Citizen Lab. So I think I mentioned this in Black Code, that the idea for the book originated many years ago, probably about the time when I met Hugh Siegel, in fact. And in the late 1990s, I'd finished this book, Parchment Printing and Hypermedia, and I was very much a conventional scholar, I would say, in the Department of Political Science here, meaning that I was working mostly solo. I was interested in this area, but I felt a little frustrated that there were limits to my technical knowledge. And I'd actually debated going back to school and taking courses in engineering, or maybe some kind of field trip or sabbatical where I'd spend time looking at and trying to better understand the telecommunications infrastructure of the globe. And out of the blue, it was really an incredible stroke of fortune. The Ford Foundation called me, and I was actually in my basement cleaning up a sewage disaster. I got a call, and it was the Ford Foundation in New York, and the woman at the other end of the line said, "We're trying to identify people who want to help seed research in a new field that we want to build around information technology and international security, and you're one of the people that we have in mind. Would you like to come to New York and work as a program officer?" And so I, at that time, had a young family, and I just couldn't move to New York. It wasn't in the cards. I didn't even have tenure here at the University of Toronto. So it wasn't right for me, and I declined it. They came back and they said, "Well, what if we gave you a fund, some resources, and you come up with an idea for something that you do at the University of Toronto? The only thing is it has to be interdisciplinary." And that's when I came up with the idea for Citizen Lab. So instead of training myself to better learn the technologies and maybe acquaint myself with computer programming and so on, I actually got the resources and went out and hired people. And one of the first people that I hired was a student in a course of mine named Nart Villeneuve, who is certainly a major character in Black Code and was a central person in the Citizen Lab for many years. There's a funny story about Nart. He was taking my graduate course, and as a paper topic, he came up with what I thought was an incredible idea to test the limits of internet censorship in China by searching through the internet for computers that he could connect to and log on to, and then kind of reverse surf outwards as if he was in China. And he started systematically testing to see which websites were accessible or not. And I thought, this is extraordinary, and I gave him an A, of course, and I said, "Why don't you come work in this new lab I'm creating called the Citizen Lab?" And so he came and he worked for me, and that paper topic actually became the basis for at least one portion of our core methodology for many years, which we expanded out, added field research into it, working with people. We ended up doing the same thing, more or less, that NARC had developed in more than 70 countries on an annual basis at one point in the 2000s. Really extraordinary. The funny thing about NARD is, after a few months, the financial people at the Monk School came to me and said, this fellow that's working for you, NARD, he hasn't submitted a timesheet. So I went to NARD and I said, you know, in order to get paid, you have to submit a timesheet. He couldn't actually believe that someone would pay him to do what he would have done anyways, because he's a homegrown hacker. And that's been kind of the secret of the Citizen Lab. It's actually not so much what I do as marshaling together really talented, ingenious people, many of whom are not necessarily classically trained, who really understand technologies and exploring the internet. And I guess, you know, part of the rationale for it is to put those people whose interests are really their hobbies, their passion, to work around a more systematic approach to trying to understand whether there are threats to this open commons of information, this wonderful world that we've created, as it becomes securitized. And of course, it's led to one thing after another. The book actually got its start at the very beginning of the Citizen Lab, and the Citizen Lab itself was meant to be a place for me to engage in the primary research that would end up in a book called Black Code. But what happened was we got involved in so many interesting investigations that were just so overwhelmingly not only complex and demanding, but really interesting. Many of them ended up having real-world implications, so we would be publishing reports that we would see in the newspapers, and that was extraordinary. So the book kept getting pushed back, and finally, a couple of years ago, I decided, no, I really must do this, and I got together with the people at McClellan Stewart. Jenny Bradshaw is my editor, is here now, so thank you. You're a wonderful person. So the book was actually published on May 21st, 2013, which I believe is the very day that Edward Snowden fled from Hawaii to Hong Kong. And the first story came out June 5th. And, you know, I've thought about this since the Snowden revelations have come out. Was it a good thing that the book was published just prior to the Snowden revelations, or would it have been better if I could have dealt with some of the material? And of course, we put out a paperback edition. I got to write a new foreword to it that addresses some of it. But I'm actually really glad that it came out before, because I used to give lectures on the topics that we research at the Citizen Lab to audiences like this. And one of the things I'd ask, I'd say, everybody put up your hand if you've heard of CSIS, and everyone would put up their hand. Then I would say CSEC, and almost very rarely, maybe one person would have known of this agency. And now, thanks to Edward Snowden, it's, you know, on the top of most people's minds. It's extraordinary to see these conversations that are happening on the front pages of the newspapers that were really hidden in the shadows for many decades. And only known about by either those who work in those agencies, or a few specialists, or people, and I see a lot of these people now, who were considered by their friends and family members to be complete, you know, paranoid, tinfoil hat wearing, you know, this guy, he thinks that the government can listen to everything, and of course he's nuts. But now, of course, many of these people feel vindicated. I just met somebody actually last couple nights ago in London, Ontario, who I knew about as a resource, just a private individual interested in this area, who had written a personal blog about CSEC for many years. He was a peace activist, not an academic, it's not part of his job or anything. He would write this public blog about CSEC, the most meticulous research. And I'm sure before Snowden, most people thought this guy's completely out to lunch. And yet he's now a resource that's cited by many people, so he feels great about it. In terms of the Snowden revelations, you know, where to begin on this? I've heard that, first of all, the volume of documents that he took is incredible. To put it in some perspective, so June 5th was the first revelation, and roughly every week there's been another document coming out, either in The Guardian or The New York Times or Washington Post or CBC or whatever. So about one a week since then. At that rate, it would take 46 years for all the documents to come out. So he took a lot of material. And we've only seen the first few glimpses of what's going on. I think in the short term, it's obviously raising a lot of awareness about the things that I've been speaking about in Black Code. After all, the theme of Black Code is that we live in paradoxical times, that as never before we're surrounded by so much technology, and yet for most people it's kind of a mystery what goes on beneath the surface, and yet that is where power is exercised by state authorities. So insofar as Snowden has helped lift the lid on the internet, I think that's a very good thing. And I think it's spurred on investigative journalism. So people are asking questions they wouldn't have asked and cross-referencing the documents. There are stories that have nothing to do with the Snowden documents. Like, for example, Colin Freeze in the Globe and Mail is starting to do ATIP, or Freedom of Information requests, that are not necessarily derived from the Snowden documents directly, but are shedding light on things that he wouldn't have otherwise thought to ask about. I think those are good things, but I'm a little concerned that in the short run, anyway, the implications are actually going to be pretty bad, and in fact accelerate some of the troubling characteristics that I outline in Black Code. I'll say a couple of remarks about what I mean by that. So, if you put yourself in a position of a government that's not allied with the United States, especially a government in the global south, and looking at the Snowden revelations, president and prime minister of that country, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to turn to their head of their security agency and say, all of this stuff that's going on, are we being spied on by the Americans? And the head of the Secret Service security agency in country X will say, I don't know, but to find out, I need $25 million of the most advanced equipment and capabilities that will allow me to answer that question for you. And of course, many of the countries that I'm concerned about are not democratic countries. They're autocratic, authoritarian regimes who will use those very same capabilities, and now with the image of the NSA in mind, to direct them against their own populations. And we've certainly seen evidence of that. So if you look, India, just to take one example that I'm familiar with, has passed a program for what they're calling a central monitoring system. They're going to monitor all of the communications in India. They're actually pointing explicitly to the United States and the NSA as a model. And in fact, going further, they're asking for advice on how to do this from the United States. China just announced that it was meeting with Iran on a new national intranet for that country. So we'll see more of them. We'll see other NSAs, and I think that will be really problematic. The answer to this, I think, really boils down to us here in countries like Canada getting our own house in order. I think in order for us to prevent this from happening, we need to be able to credibly look to other countries around the world and say, what you're doing is wrong. You just can't spy on your own people and arrest them using these technologies and so forth. But to be able to do that credibly, we have to not be doing it ourselves. And that's the big problem, of course, is that we're living in a system here that for many decades was kind of hidden in the shadows. And only now are we beginning to see glimmers of light into these dark corners of agencies that really are not publicly accountable in ways that I think are proper to a liberal democratic society. So in our country, I think it's perhaps the worst of all when it comes to the liberal democratic countries. It's very much a British type of system, but peculiarly, is that right? Canadian, in that there's a kind of Ottawa establishment where things are done more according to norms and culture than by laws and regulations, and so an adjustment has to be made, I think, in this country, which is why the hearing today is an important first step. So CSIC, for example, does not answer to Parliament. So the fact that they were going before the Senate committee really means nothing. They do not have to respond if they don't want to. Furthermore, the oversight of CSEC is from a retired judge, the CSEC commissioner, who reports to the Minister of Defense. So it is accountability and oversight within the security tent. You know, to me, that's a structural flaw in the architecture of our democracy. Right? It's a real problem. And then, just stepping back, I'll say, we live in, you often hear, we live in extraordinary times, but I think when it comes to communications and security, we really do live in extraordinary times, because the communications changes that have happened, that we're all experiencing, have happened in such an abbreviated period of time. So the rise of social media, cloud computing, mobile, those three together are really only like 5 to 10 years old. And they're different in many ways, but they share one very important characteristic, which I believe makes them fundamentally important in terms of human history. The amount of information that used to be in our desktops and our filing cabinets and so on, that we now entrust to third parties. Almost all of those third parties are private companies. Many of them are private companies that actually are headquartered in another jurisdiction from the one in which we're citizens. And it's not just information that we are conscious of, like the content of our phone calls when we're using our mobile phones, or the texts we make, or the emails we send. It's, as we're learning, again, thanks to Edward Snowden, and I talked about this in Black Code, metadata. So data about data. The best example comes from my mobile phone. So does everyone have a mobile phone right now? Is there anyone who doesn't have a mobile phone? That's the best one. 1, 2, 3, few people. So unfortunately,
does everyone turn them off though?
Even that will make you stick out. But even when we're not using them, mine's on vibrate, it's still emitting a pulse as a beacon to the nearest Wi-Fi router, which is somewhere in this building, or the cell phone tower, which is probably above Robarts. You see the funny tower there. And within the beacon is the make and model of the phone, the fact that it's my phone, because my name is attached to the operating system, and most importantly, the geolocation of the phone. And all of your phones are doing that as well. And that information doesn't just evaporate into the atmosphere. It sits on the servers of the Wi-Fi router or the cell phone tower. And whoever owns and operates that infrastructure decides what they can do with it. And of course, as we're finding out now, government security agencies are gathering up that data and analyzing it, because it's extraordinarily powerful and revealing information. The fact that we're all sitting here now means we're connected. Someone can look at the metadata and say, all of you were in the same room at the same time, listening to Ron Deaver. So you're all in trouble. You're implicated. But that's happening, this communications revolution. We can go on a lot more about that, just that element. At the same time that the security environment is changing. So if you look at governments and security threats, not that long ago, during the Cold War, the primary security threat was really other countries, other state adversaries, and the concern was that some country is going to lob ballistic missiles over the horizon, and we need to anticipate that. And that's really where modern signals intelligence agencies got their start, trying to eavesdrop on adversaries on the other side of the planet to anticipate their moves, to find out what they were doing. And of course, after 9/11 especially, the threat environment changed substantially. It's no longer really some government on the other side of the planet. It's the possibility that someone in a room like this, God forbid, would have explosives and a backpack and blow themselves up. So at the very same time that we're turning our lives inside out, governments are focusing inwards on all of us. And that's happened only within the last like 5 to 10 years. So we've not had a chance yet as a society to discuss this maturely. What does this mean for us? How do we deal with this? What should be the appropriate checks and balances for a liberal democratic society and a state intelligence agency in that environment? So I don't know how much more time I've got.
You can go on for a long time. Go on.
Okay, I really want to have a discussion with people, but I'll say about the latest revelations. So I got a call from Greg Weston. I'm trying to think while I'm speaking. I hope I don't divulge anything. But
we'll stay within this room, Ron.
Yes. Greg Weston, who's the journalist with the CBC. So Edward Snowden took all of these documents. Of course, Glenn Greenwald is the primary source. You can imagine the volume of documents here. What Greenwald has done is essentially go out and he's selected a news organization in each country or a journalist that's of relevance and teamed up with them, and he has chosen Greg Weston and CBC. So the first two stories that came out were CBC stories about the Snowden documents. And I can't remember now, but a week and a half ago, Greg Weston emailed me in the clear, which is a problem. I can talk a bit more about that. Saying, would you like to be a part of this, my next story? And the issue for him was he had to give me the documents, hand them to me, and I was out in Vancouver. So we had to arrange for the documents to be delivered to the Citizen Lab. I wanted the staff at the Citizen Lab to be able to review them with me. And he managed to hand deliver them. As soon as I looked at them, I realized I had a problem because they're marked top secret presentation and they weren't published yet. And so immediately I thought, okay, this is bad because if you look at the Security and Information Act, used to be the old Official Secrets Act, it's now the new name, there are several statutes in there that say quite explicitly what I was doing was a crime. And so I was really worried about that. I thought, anybody who's monitoring Greg Weston's email, and of course they'll be monitoring Greg Weston's email, would know that he's interested in giving those documents to me, and I have them at the Citizen Lab. I was mostly concerned that there might be a subpoena against the Citizen Lab, and something like that could set our work back for years, even though I think it would be outrageous, and we ultimately win the fight. It's not out of the realm of the possible that this would happen. So I took it actually to a lawyer, James Lockyer. I don't know if anybody knows him. And Janice Stein and I went over to see James. And so after we reviewed the document, I signed it and put it with a lawyer. And I thought this is the right thing to do because then it's not my possession. I've reviewed the documents, and that's where they sit. So CBC has now published the documents, but redacted parts of it. I think most of the redactions were actually quite wise, because you don't want to publish everything like this if you actually get some people in danger and maybe reveal things that really shouldn't be revealed. But when I reviewed the documents, the first thing I thought was, okay, the first two revelations that came out regarding Canada, there's the Brazil, spying on the Brazil mines and so on, and the one about the G20 here in Toronto, the CSEC and NSA, set up a listening post in Ottawa on the G20. Neither of those did I think were remarkable, actually. I thought, well, you could say it's not prudent to spy on Brazil, but still it's not unlawful. And the G20 revelation, I thought, well, that's kind of what they do. I would have expected that. But this one definitely is on a whole different level. And I'm glad I'm here to talk about this because I think the coverage has been really misleading. The coverage has been about free Wi-Fi at airports. It's not about that at all, actually. That's a small component of it. If you look at the documents carefully, it's much more concerning. So CSEC, who has consistently and adamantly stressed that they are not targeting Canadians, they are prohibited by law from collecting communications on Canadians. In this presentation, it is clear that what they have done is gone to what's described as a Canadian special source, which I assume to be a major telecommunications company in Canada. And then it's also clear they've gone to several databases of mysterious origin. They have code names on them. Some, I think, are GCHQ databases. Some are NSA databases. Some are Canadian databases. Others are actually commercial databases that give geolocation information of devices. So these devices have ID numbers, right? Information that is like a signature or a fingerprint of each device. They've taken all of the device IDs for a period of time and then tracked them as they've gone through airports throughout the country. And they did an experiment on at least one medium-sized city airport, but that experiment goes into cities, to hotels, to Wi-Fi hotspots, to enterprises, to hotels. So, you know, a considerable experiment was done, essentially swooping up in a ubiquitous surveillance program involving, no doubt about it, Canadian communications. Now, the interesting thing is, I think, you look at this and clearly this is unlawful and it's against the mandate of CSEC. What's happening now, I suspect we'll find out, is the government has been using a different English dictionary than the rest of us. So for them, targeting doesn't mean that I think it's targeting. Tracking means something completely different. Incidental is something that they would describe this as being. So for the average human being, none of this makes sense. And it's a real problem. It gets back to this issue of what I spoke about, that we have this collision of, you know, the social media explosion that we're going through at the same time as these huge agencies are turning inward. The problem in our country is they've been operating under a kind of Cold War logic and using secret interpretations of secret laws to justify what they're doing. I don't know whether any abuse has happened or not, but the potential for abuse here is really practically limitless. And that's something that is very, very serious, I would say. And I hope this serves as a wake-up call. If not, maybe 25 years from now, there'll be another set of Snowden documents. We'll be looking at them. So I don't know. I could keep going on forever, but I'd really like to talk to you.
Well, if I may start off, you mentioned what seems to be the Brazil caper.
Yes.
A simple-minded kind of narrative of it is CSEC managed to get into the Brazil Department of Mines, and they found out where they were putting some money and giving some opportunities and so on. And there were, perhaps, some Canadian mining companies that were active there. My information is there was nothing very significant. But the implication of that is that then the government can help the Canadian mining company that will help the government in power, or political party in power. And that was the sort of kind of logic you could see, and it might or might not be the case. But my question really is, are we at a stage now where this kind of misuse of internet accessibility is affecting our internal, our national political process?
You know, that's the million-dollar question. And, there is no evidence of abuse right now. I would say, you know, that's the scenario you outlined is something we have to be concerned about, because we really, it boils down to the issue of independent judicial oversight or some kind of independent oversight, which presently is absent in this country. I don't believe the current arrangement is really any oversight to speak of. And actually, Hugh Siegel said the same thing. I was on a panel with him. So, you know, we're not exactly ideologically aligned, I would say, but on this topic, he very much agrees with me. So we just don't know. You know, that's the thing. I doubt it. I actually think that Brazil operation looked to me like a project report that CSEC was doing for NSA, meaning that the NSA was actually asking CSEC to do this and report back. And that is also a concern, because here we have an enormous agency, that, you know, global surveillance capacity. We're a minor partner in that operation. So as a Canadian citizen, as a taxpayer, I think there's a fair question to ask just on that level, to what extent are our precious resources being directed by another country? You know, it's fair to say, I think we have obviously close relationships and we have to be strategic about it. We want to cooperate on so many different levels because it's our most important trading partner and all of that. So I'm not saying don't do that. I'm saying to what extent does that happen and it may prejudice our national interests.
The implications of the airport thing, at least the suggestion of some people, was that it was in part the CSEC guys, shall we say, saying, hey, we can do this stuff too. What do you think?
Yeah.
Did it have that aspect to it?
For sure. A lot of the presentations have, you know, the kind of gee whiz factor and exclamation points, and this is great. There was one that one of the most important Snowden revelations concerned the NSA hacking into the transmission between databases on Google servers and putting a little smiley face on it saying, you know, we did this, it's a great success. And that really irritated the Google security engineers. So, you know, part of it is really ingenious. You look at the presentation. I have a colleague who's a professor at Berkeley who was tweeting saying, this would be a great paper submission for a scientific journal. You know, what they outlined there was actually really ingenious about IP profiling and ID, movements of IDs and so on. Really interesting stuff. So on that level, I think it's great. And what I saw demonstrated in the Brazil operation actually says to me, we have pretty good capabilities. The question is not about the technical side of it, it's the political side. You know, that we really need to have proper oversight over such extraordinary capabilities, especially because it's not a time when people talk to each other over landlines and, you know, the image of the spy listening in, tapping something. It's not like that at all. Our personal lives, we've turned them inside out. And extraordinarily intimate details about all of us now exist on servers, on private company computers. If the government can just access it willy-nilly with no protection or safeguards to speak of, we have a real problem at the heart of our democracy.
What is your opinion of Mr. Snowden's action, and what is your estimate of the future that awaits him? And the PS to that question is, if your cell phone is turned off, can they still track you?
Right. So Edward Snowden, I think in time it will be widely acknowledged that this was the most important leak in intelligence history. I think it already has demonstrated that, but the volume of documents, no doubt about it. Is he a traitor or a whistleblower? In my opinion, I think the extent to which he shed light on the excesses of what's going on with signals intelligence agencies certainly justify his actions as a whistleblower. There's a separate question, though, around kind of the process of how he went about doing what he did. Fair question to ask. Should he have stayed in the United States and taken the punishment? Or should he have fled in the manner that he did? Because by fleeing, obviously that opens up questions as to whether he's being controlled by a foreign government. I understand, pragmatically speaking, where else is he going to go? If he's actually going to flee, you really only have one or two places where you are essentially insulated from the reach of the United States. I wouldn't put it past them to try to find him and maybe deport him physically. So being in Russia, I think, gives him some protection against that. I hope that at some point he's able to recover some of his life, because right now it must be pretty miserable. I think he can't really move or communicate freely. So it's a tough decision that he had to make. In terms of the phone, yeah, of course. It's, you know, these are hugely convenient, really extraordinary devices that give us all sorts of freedom and allow us to connect to each other and socialize and know where we are at any moment and find, you know, when is the next streetcar coming? Oh, I can look on my app and it's coming in 5 minutes. This is fantastic. But even when it's not on, when it's not being used, it's still emitting a signal. It's still connected. And that signal is constantly sending out, as I said, a kind of set of identifiers.
Even when it's turned off?
Well, when it's turned off, that's a separate issue. Even there, though, I think if you look at some of the capabilities that were outlined in one of the more recent Snowden revelations in The Guardian, or actually it was in Der Spiegel, they had the catalog of all the NSA's tricks of the trade, products that they are purchasing and so on. And some of those talk about extraordinary ways that they can get inside computers using radio waves and things like that. And I think there are some that are outlined there about getting inside computers at a level when it's even off, they can turn it on. It really depends on the firmware, the hardware, how it's constituted. And there's a problem here, again, socially, that I talk about a bit in Black Code, where, you know, this is a proprietary phone. Apple doesn't allow you to open up this phone. The code is proprietary. Only Apple knows what's actually in the code, right? But Apple's headquartered in the United States and subject to the Patriot Act and all of the national security laws. And as we found out, Apple likely colluded with the NSA. So really don't know. It's a leap of faith when you purchase one of these, unless they're open source and you can look at the code and understand what's going on beneath the hood, which I think we need more of. We need to encourage people.
At the back, George Featherton.
So I have a question. To paraphrase Joseph Stalin, when he said the death of one man is a tragedy, the death of a million is a statistic. The loss of privacy of an individual by an abuse by a security agency is obviously a bad thing for that individual. But scooping up vast quantities of data from, say, the population of this room then becomes a statistic. How, as an advocate for awareness on the subject, do you kind of bring home to people kind of the potential monstrous indignity of this wholesale harvesting of geographic and personal information?
So that's an excellent question. And I think it's more and more of a challenge with people who have lived in it, digital natives who have grown up in it, because it's I would count myself as that to some extent. I've kind of seen the whole process unfold, but very much embedded in it. So there are trade-offs that have been made around privacy already, and I think especially young people are very comfortable with their lives being exposed, that in generations, maybe two or three generations earlier, would have been considered really inappropriate. So, you know, I'm sure a lot of people have children or grandchildren, nieces and nephews. You look at what they're posting on Facebook, you think that, you know, there's no way that would have been appropriate. Now it's acceptable. So there's that kind of level, and to me, I think the way to get at the issue is not through the issue of privacy or trying to argue for privacy. It is instead to talk about the potential for abuse of unchecked power. Because I don't think we can go back to a time when people communicated in a much more contained fashion than we do now. And actually, going further, I would say, nor should we. I think the basis of all of this stuff that we live in now, is actually wonderful, and going through that's even necessary for the future of the human race. We need these technologies to be able to ensure that we have a chance of solving some of the enormous problems we face together on the planet. And surveillance is actually very good. It's an important means to that end. You think about satellite surveillance for environmental monitoring, for example. So we need surveillance for disease, right? Like, all of that stuff is really important. Mass surveillance is not the issue. It's about the state and security agencies that have access to the data that we emit as we go about our daily lives without anybody who's independent from the state, who's credible, looking into it and saying, well, they can't use it for that purpose, right? And that's the problem that we don't. And if we don't do that here, very quickly, we're going to find we're living in a world that's determined by others, who have no experience with those checks and balances. And that's what's happening very quickly over here.
I had two questions. The first was to do with oversight, the Senate jurisdiction. So on oversight, earlier today, Senator Dallaire mentioned that the Senate Committee on National Security and Defense has no parliamentary oversight because it's not privy to classified materials. And Senator Siegel made a similar comment that we have a system of full-time surveillance and part-time oversight.
Well, that's a good way of putting it.
So I was curious how you, do you believe that, you clearly don't believe that retired judges have the technical expertise to oversee the CSEC or even the political appointees to over the Security Intelligence Review Committee to oversee CSIS. So the first question is, what is the ideal oversight function that you could foresee or ideally like to see in a parliamentary system? The second question is about jurisdiction, and some of the reaction has been about moving service to Canadian soil, putting subject to Canadian law, and having more IXBs in Canada. Is that a reasonable reaction, or is that just a knee-jerk, naive understanding of jurisdiction in a surveillance system?
So, again, those are excellent questions. I don't pretend to have the answers around exactly what the oversight would look like, and I think there are legal issues that need to be addressed that are well beyond capabilities, and there are really some very smart people in this country who understand the law around surveillance and lawful access, and really need to think that through. All I know is what exists now is insufficient, and the potential for abuse is almost limitless. In my opinion, the broad contours would be something like we need to have an oversight body that is separate from the Ottawa establishment, first of all. I still find, I've lived in Toronto for many years and I've gone to Ottawa quite often. I actually worked for Canadian government when I was a graduate student at one point, and close to, not as part of the intelligence community, but I understand what that community is like. And it is really a cloistered environment, in my opinion. I don't think they fully get it in Ottawa. It's very inside baseball, and it's a culture that people, and I think that's partly why we see some of the abuses going on in other areas, like the Senate scandal and all that stuff. So it needs to be an independent body that's not made up of the Ottawa establishment, that contains at least one or more who have no stake in the system. Maybe like Margaret Atwood or something, right? A person who's not part of this, who we trust, right? Who has some legitimacy. Beyond that, I don't know. The devil would be in the details, but we don't have that now. The jurisdiction issue is really interesting. So there are many people, some of my colleagues actually in this university were up in arms because there was a proposal to have our email contracted out to Microsoft. And they said, will you sign a petition with us to argue against this? And I was about to sign, wait a minute. We're actually advocating not to contract to Microsoft because of all the obvious issues, PRISM, NSA, yada yada, I get that. But the alternative seems a little dubious to me, to advocate to have something locally here in Canada. And at that time, this is prior to the latest Snowden revelation, I was saying, we really don't want, it's like, I said in my Globe and Mail article, advocating to move data hosting from US to Canada is like advocating to move from a dimly lit cave to a pitch black tunnel at the back of it. So I know that's solved, but I can't go for that.
Back to
Tom Wilson. Two questions. Briefly, can you comment on BlackBerry's supposed superior security aspect? And then more broadly, your book touches on, and you haven't spoken tonight about, the criminal element in the internet.
Well, that's one of my favorite topics for sure, BlackBerry. I guess around 2010, I started hearing the stories about BlackBerry and the ultimatums that were being issued to BlackBerry by governments like the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and so on. And at the time, BlackBerry was saying, our technology is so super secret, even we can't even give people the keys. So there's no way we can make these deals. And I was like, okay, but then BlackBerry is still being used in those countries, and the governments are okay. So something didn't add up. I think that it's clear that some type of dubious arrangement was made between BlackBerry and in those countries. And I think the degree to which the company has not been transparent about it is really incorrigible, in my opinion. I think, especially given the fact that the way they've done it has been so arrogant, in my opinion. Some of the ways that it's been conveyed to the public, I think, is irresponsible. And I was arguing that on the basis of statements that were made by the company, and then looking at what was going on in some of these countries, where if you actually look at the local press in places like India, they were saying, oh no, we've reached an agreement, we've got wholesale monitoring of BlackBerry going on, and furthermore, BlackBerry's actually set up a system where they're training technicians in Waterloo as to how to do the monitoring. Right, so that was being reported on in India, and BlackBerry saying something completely different. In my opinion, we need to hold companies accountable in the same way that we need to hold governments accountable, given the era of big data that we live in. And their assurances they make on their websites or their brochures or even their terms of service are not enough. We need to have rigorous, independent monitoring of what they're doing and greater transparency. So at the Citizen Lab, we have one of our postdoctoral fellows, Chris Parsons, has started a letter writing campaign where he sent letters to, I think, 10 or so, maybe a dozen telecommunication companies in Canada, urging them to publish what are known as transparency reports. Give us details on the number of requests you get from governments for user data. In the United States, Google, Facebook, Twitter, Yahoo, Verizon, AT&T, all now publish transparency reports. There may be a few others that I'm missing. Here in Canada, there's not even a discussion about it. And of course, why? Because some of the companies are obviously being pressured or colluded to work with law enforcement and security agencies. Of course, that arrangement has to happen at some level. The world is a bad place, and law enforcement needs to have capabilities. They need to go to the telecommunications companies, but without a warrant, it just doesn't make sense to me as a liberal Democrat. Like, that's kind of the bedrock of a system of checks and balances.
Criminal stuff?
The
criminal question.
Yeah. Oh, the criminal stuff. I see. So cybercrime is enormous. It's, you know, it's getting worse because the volume of data that's out there is getting larger, and the turnover in our applications and devices that we use is happening more and more quickly. So all of that's creating more vectors for exploitation for cybercrime. And the communication system that we live in is international, but law enforcement is national. Even worse, I would say, is that we are now seeing governments, talk a bit about this in the Black Code, governments like Syria, Iran, other countries, using the tradecraft of cybercrime and directing it against opposition groups, either in their own countries or abroad. It is a major problem, and I think it's not getting any better. Sure.
We have a question here.
Hi. Hello. So you've been talking mostly about monitoring communications and internet activity kind of while it's happening, but isn't another dimension of this, you know, storing this information, whether it's in this new CSEC facility in Ottawa or the huge new NSA facility? And as sort of sub-questions, firstly, does that mean that every encrypted archive out there is just sitting in a server waiting for enough computing power and good enough algorithms to crack it? And secondly, is this giving the power to kind of look up everything in a person's life at any point in the future?
Yeah.
You know, you're being considered for a Supreme Court justiceship, and they go back and look at your Google searches from when you're a teenager.
Yeah, this is a huge issue. I talk in Black Code, I think I have the quotation from the UCLA engineer, John Villa Sr. And when I read it, I thought this is exactly the concern. He has this point about, you know, most of us don't remember what we did on May 24th, 2011, what we wore that day, what we purchased, with whom we communicated, and so on. But all of that data exists somewhere. It's available. And anyone who has access to that data can reconstruct in perfect detail what you did on that day. And of course, there's a debate in Europe about a law called the right to be forgotten. And I, you know, socially, this is, again, one of those things that we're going to have to start grappling with the unintended consequences of what we've created. One of them will be this. You know, people need to make mistakes in their lives and then have the opportunity to recover from it and not necessarily be persecuted for it for the rest of their lives. We live in a society where we're encouraged, this has nothing to do with the state, to share everything. And young people especially might be cavalier in ways that they won't 10 years later. Certainly I was. And I would hate to go back and look at the archives of my life from my undergraduate years. I know my wife would feel the same way too.
Michael Narrows.
Thank you. Ron, could you address a worry that I have that a lot of people have asked about and to which you've given several different kinds of answers? You've answered them well, but they are different sides of the same problem. And the problem is the need for greater oversight and monitoring. And my question is, has the technology developed to the point that the managers are so far ahead of the likely monitors that we're going to have? I mean, the idea that this evening there are a group of senators, presumably, monitoring this ultra-complex world.
Careful, one's going to be the new master.
Well, with all due respect, the idea that the wonks who work for the managers are at the same level as the monitors and the overseers, I just don't find this credible. I mean, most of us think in terms of accountancy. So they're the smart, bad guys who are managing the business, managing the businesses, and then there are the very smart forensic accountants, and they're more or less on the same level, and we more or less have confidence that the forensic accountants, in the long run, we'll find out what the bad guys are up to. But in this area, it seems to me, the managers are so far ahead. As you describe it yourself, it's the managers who are training the so-called overseers. Now, how much confidence do we have that there's really equality of arms between these two? And I think that's very worrisome.
Yeah. And that's precisely why I think whatever oversight exists has to be separate from that Ottawa establishment tent, right? I think the answer to that is we need many different types of oversight. We have to be creative about thinking about it, because not only do we have to worry about the managers, as you call them, in government, the security agencies, we have to worry about what the companies are doing. And the number of companies are extraordinary. When you think about, let's go back to the mobile phone, there's Apple and the iPhone, right? But within in my iPhone anyway, probably the same for a lot of you, I have probably about 24 apps. Each of the apps are made by a different company that may be located or headquartered in another country. So in terms of oversight, we need something different than just a body. I think we have to think about this in a distributed fashion. In the book, I talk about this idea of distributed security. There's one part of the book that I think is the least developed. It's the, okay, what do we do now part? And part of that is around this idea of distributed security. What does that mean? I think it means distributing as widely as possible mechanisms of oversight, including from civil society. I believe that the type of oversight that's done by Citizen Lab itself is a good example of the type of oversight that we will need. We need organizations like Citizen Lab. I don't need to say this in a boastful way, but I'm just using it as one model, or others like them out there as well, that whose mission is to persistently and carefully, using the basis of evidence research, lift the lid on what's going on and use framework of the university or the platform of the university to publish this in a way where you're not afraid of the consequences. You publish it and you raise awareness to the public in that way. And I think the more we have that in a distributed fashion, the better hope we'll have of preventing abuse from occurring. And I think that's actually taking place. If you look at the Snowden revelations, whistleblowers, WikiLeaks, whatever you think of those organizations, Julia said, put that aside for a minute. The internet has provided a remarkable way for people to leak documents. Think about this. Edward Snowden took all of that, working for 3 months at Booz Allen Hamilton as a subcontractor to the NSA. I mean, the first thing I thought of, what's the guy next to him doing? So, you know, we need to have a distributed mechanism of oversight and accountability.
Let's do one more question, and then we can reconvene in the bar.
I hope this question's a sensible segue to what you just said. I'm thinking about catching them at it, and from my sort of amateur knowledge of intelligence, planning bogus data to see where it turns up is a good technique. Very short story. Years ago, I went on a mailing with the city cycling committee at City Hall, and there was a bogus variant on my name. I used to do this deliberately, and one day I got a solicitation for one sort of mayoral candidate with that bogus variation, so I had them. Is that a useful line of thought for thinking about what civil society or individuals can do? Is there something we can
do? Absolutely. I think that within one of the things that I didn't talk about tonight, but we take very seriously at Citizen Lab, is the question of ethics of our own research, including the methods of things. So you can be very clever and ingenious, but you don't want to cross a line. You don't want to break the law in Canada in order to do this job. But you also have to be, because there are some laws that don't even cover what you're doing. You have to be ethical about it. But you can catch, let's call it wrongdoing, if you will, or violations of human rights in very clever ways. We've got a method that we call the fingerprinting project at the lab. We've developed a way to identify the products that are being used in countries around the world for censorship and surveillance. And it's, if I had 2 hours, I could then bring people from the lab to show you. It's remarkable. But it is, in part, using clever kind of tricks and getting at evidence that's left by these companies unintentionally. You'll hit a block page in Pakistan, and if you know how to look at the code of that block page, it'll tell you in such a way that you can say for certain it's this company. And I think we need more of that clever forensic investigation going on, which, by the way, I'll say is one last point. Here at the university, I take very seriously the university's role in all of this. We need to change the disciplinary divisions that are at the heart of the university, which is why Citizen Lab being at the Monk School is very important. It's an interdisciplinary school. People are trained in silos. As a political scientist, I know I never had any training or engagement with computer science or engineering. In the engineering schools, I talk to people all the time, a lot of my staff, they have maybe one kind of throwaway course on, public policy and computers or something, right? And that's it for their whole training. This has to change. It's absurd, right? We need to have a complete redrawing of the boundaries in order to educate people effectively to live in the technological society that we live in. So I don't know if that's it.
Thank our speaker. I did notice that Ron's wife wanted to ask a question, but she's. But I'm sort of intrigued. What would the question be?
Which mine was more of a theoretical nature, because Chris Parsons of the Citizen Lab was on the Current this morning, and I thought he spoke really well on the issue of the C-Sec and their surveilling people, possibly the reason why. And he said, well, they're not actually spying on me, they're spying on a representation of me. And I thought, I've never thought of it that way. So all those times, if you look back at your 15-year-old Google searches, was that you, or was that just a representation of you? And then the legality around that, well, maybe CSEC isn't actually spying on us, so they could get around it. I don't know that one. And on the flip side of that, are we creating little mini human versions of ourselves with these machines?
We are nodes.
So I was. It wasn't me that was being solicited for funds. It was a representation.
That's
a
good question.
It's a good question. But you must take them every night.
Yes.
on behalf of everyone, I'm supposed to thank you. I was thinking that I got disabused tonight of a kind of a fantasy. 35 years ago, I was posted in China. And I said this was the pre-Jurassic era. I can remember when the bug came on the line. I was just talking to Elizabeth McCallum in Hong Kong, and suddenly a voice said, please speak louder, more clearly. And I said, well, I can hear her okay. There were only then about 20 foreign correspondents in Peking, as we used to call it, and they had enough people who could understand English, and they would be giving reports. And then as the whole thing exploded, I thought, well, that's the protection, that the sheer volume is going to kill it. And then when I saw with the Southern Fellows, we were taken to the former Stasi headquarters in Berlin, and I saw the volume of paper and the stupidity of the information that was going. I thought, well, it's died on its own course. But this is something altogether new in that it is so much the specifics, although they can't get the specifics, it's the trends and the manipulation. And that's a little bit Orwellian. On the other hand, I think the antidotes are there too. You know, come the hour, comes the person, comes you, and Citizen Lab, and Snowden, whatever you think of them, because, not to quote Karl Marx, but you know, one thing begets another thing. And we are so grateful that the Citizen Lab is up the street, it was across the street. I was thrilled to watch your ascent across the street. You were down in sort of Lubyanka in the Monk Center.
That's it. It's now Scott's.
It's a great place.
Yeah, I know. It was way down there. And then suddenly, he appears on the front page of the New York Times, and you were sort of lifted up by Professor Stein. And now you're about the highest spot on the university in the But it's a tribute to what you've accomplished there. And again, a short time. And we're very lucky to have you here.
Thanks very
Thank
much.
Thank you for coming.